Hello and welcome to the Tax Files. My name is Ali Kazmi and I'm delighted to be joined today by my co-host, Ektar. Hello, Ektar.
Hi, Ali. Welcome again to the Tax Files, a monthly audio podcast where alongside an esteemed guest, we'll be discussing the most pertinent topics for tax and accounting professionals, while also getting to know some key members of the tax industry just that little bit better. Ali, how have you been?
Fantastic. I've been, I suppose, just recovering from the sort of like the year-end festivities, and the year is just now galloping, I would say. It has been a good start to the year, been very busy, and you may have heard that we Hansuke is rebranding. We're going to be known as WTS Hansuke in the UK market.
Yes, I have heard. Very exciting times. Is it keeping you nice and busy with the rebrand?
It is. I love working with these media types, you know. It's fun. Yeah. I better not say anything because I'll get myself into trouble. But anyway, more importantly, how have you been keeping?
I'm good, Ali. I'm good. Exactly the same as you. The year just seems to be flying. Honestly, it's gone from let's talk about January and post-festivity to what are we doing this summer and, you know, all of those things. So I've actually spent most of my morning refreshing my internet browser, trying to get tickets for the T20 World Cup that's taking place in the States this year. They are very hard to get hold of. I don't know if any of our listeners are into cricket, but God, I'm telling you now, if you want some, you've got to get on there quickly because there aren't that many available.
Well, I'm coming with you.
Let's do it. We'll take the Tax Files on tour. So any of our US listeners, get ready because we're coming to a city or a state near you soon.
Excellent.
Well, look, welcome to the 12th episode of the Tax Files, listeners. Thank you for joining us again. Today, we have an extra, extra special one for you. We are joined by Pascal Saint-Amans, former director of the Center for Tax Policy and Administration at the OECD, where he was hugely influential in reforming international taxation. Pascal spearheaded transformative initiatives like the base erosion and profit shifting projects and played a leading role in ending bank secrecy. Prior to his tenure at the OECD, Pascal spent over a decade in the French Ministry of Finance and also worked as an energy regulator in the French Energy Regulatory Commission. Currently, Pascal serves as a partner at the Brunswick Group, a leading critical issues consulting firm.
Excellent. So we will start shortly by asking Pascal about his background and his career journey. From there, we will discuss his vast experience in critical taxation issues that, such as BEPS that affect large businesses, and also the intricacies of wealth taxation. As always, we will finish with our rapid fire round to learn a little bit more about Pascal.
So without further ado, I'm very excited for this one. Welcome, Pascal. We're so happy that you've joined us.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everybody, depending on what time you're listening to this.
Catering to the international audience. Pascal, where in the world are you joining us from today?
I'm in my apartment in Paris. It's winter. It's a bit gloomy, but I guess that's life. So I will soon be in Biarritz enjoying surfing. So that will be better. But for the time being, it's Paris.
God, Pascal, tell me you're okay to have two guests coming with you because I know I'd rather be in a hotter climate right now than otherwise. Well, look, I'm sure all of our listeners and kind of all of our viewers are very excited to hear about your journey and how you got to where you've been. I mean, you know, doing the research pre this call, you've sort of led such an interesting journey up until this point, you know, starting off in something that wasn't necessarily a tax background and kind of obviously transitioning into it over the years. I guess the first question I have from you is how did you find yourself in your first tax-based role? What sort of motivated you to sort of enter that space?
No motivation at all. It was purely accidental. I don't know if listeners are familiar with the French system, but we have what we call a fast track, kind of an Ivy League special university or school, which is called L'École Nationale d'Administration, ENA. And that's where I went after graduating from some other schools in France. And all what determines your professional career is what's your rank, because you're ranked from first to last. And my rank at the end of that school was such as, you're already a civil servant when you're in that school. And your rank after 2 years of studies will determine where you can go and where I could go. And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to do policy work in the Ministry of Finance. Now, that could have been budget, fiscal stuff. It could have been treasury. And it ended up being the tax policy department. So I joined there. And that's where you start a career in tax. You have no background in tax and you learn with the best people because you have really good professionals and hopefully so who train you and you can decide to try to get as good as they are technically and bring the policy view. So that's the mixture of my background, which is general background and then so philosophy and economy and law, and then train on the job on tax matters, which gave me this twist of being a lawyer, kind of, but most importantly, a policymaker.
As all the best decisions, it sounds like it was a complete accident, but one that obviously has kind of worked so fantastically well over the years. My God, what do you think? I mean, kind of going from, like you say, falling into it and kind of being in that interesting meld between sort of policy and a lawyer and sort of more technical tax issues. What for you, I guess, was the key lesson that you took from kind of transitioning through all the phases through your career? How did you adapt to, I guess, the different environments and the different sort of expertise that you've sort of curated over the years? What was your secret?
I'm not sure I will respond to your question, but what I can say is that with that background of starting working on tax, I had a personal interest in international. And that's why I ended up heading the office in charge of tax treaty negotiation, transfer pricing, and so on. And that's what led me to be elected chair of Working Party One at the OECD. The Working Party One, the Committee on Fiscal Affairs, is in charge of tax treaty negotiation. So that's where I did get involved at the OECD. And then at some point, the OECD called me to join them. So I would say I was lucky, and the main takeaway would be luck to be called at the OECD. I joined the OECD when nothing much was happening, I must say, but I wanted to improve my English. That was the main motivation. And a few months after I joined the OECD, you have the subprime crisis, you have the global financial crisis. And that's where the G20 asked the OECD, which was the only international body working on tax matters, what can we do? And I had a few ideas. I told them, you know what, we need to put an end to bank secrecy. You tried in the 90s, you failed. And we need to do it. But we need to do it by being a bit tough. So we'll not succeed unless we blacklist Switzerland so that we level the playing field. But to level the playing field, we also need to invite non-OECD countries on an equal footing. And that's where the G20 liked it, other countries liked it. I mean, Switzerland didn't like it much, I must say. But we level the playing field. And by bringing all the countries, including tax havens, on an equal footing at the table, I think I gained some respect. And that's where we were able to deploy all this agenda. And the other piece of luck I benefited from was that the issue of tax and corporate tax was key, and that's why BEPS, which I came up with in 2012, was popular with finance ministers, with leaders, and that ended up in 21 with the two pillar solution and the global deal. So you know, it's a succession of luck and also ideas that you promote and innovations.
Interesting that you say it's a combination of right place, right time, you know, the landscape sort of developing in the way that it did, but also I guess you cultivating the opportunities that, or spotting rather the opportunities that would have come up at the kind of right time.
Yes, of course. I mean, you need luck and you need ideas and you need a conducive environment for that. And the OECD under the leadership of Angel Gurria, who was then Secretary General, was a good place where you could actually be an entrepreneur. You have an idea. Just go ahead, sell it, and then you do the fundraising and then you deploy. So the environment was also conducive. Plus, I must say, a fantastic team of professionals who really know the stuff and are extremely good tax economists and tax lawyers.
Pascal, absolutely humble of you, but it's also the skill that I think you brought to the table that would have kind of, I guess, propelled you in that direction and kind of, I guess, made you spearhead a lot of those kind of key groundbreaking initiatives that you just mentioned there. I mean, you know, BEPS, the bank secrecy, all of these issues that I guess were, you know, I guess part of the climate at the time, but also really took you and a personality to really kind of spearhead those and sort of maybe make some quite tough decisions and quite difficult sort of analysis at the time. If I could ask you, you know, what's going through your mind at these junctures that you sort of come into? You know, what is it in your mind, you know, for bank secrecy and the stance that you took against Switzerland? You know, what is the thought process when you're kind of going into quite difficult conversations when to do with this? Is there a way that you prepare yourself ahead of getting those done?
No, that's a good question. I think the real motivation is that the system is broken. It doesn't work. Everybody knows that. And if you go back to basics, the system doesn't work. You need to fix it in very simple terms. And if you understand the complexity and are able to explain it in simple terms, and that's the most difficult thing, right? You don't want to simplify. You simplify, you lure people into dead ends. If you say it's too complex, then you're lost and you have the subprime crisis. Nobody understands what's going on. It's too complex and you go with the flow and that's not good. So the real, I think, magic is to explain in simple terms the complexity. So that's one thing. And I think I was good at that with ministers and so. And the other thing is the motivation, moving to something which is fairer, which works better. And then you're on mission because you believe that bank secrecy has no good reason. Right. So you need to put an end to that, because otherwise you have, too many people, rich people not paying their fair share. And the outcome is that capital taxation is less than labor taxation. And that's not the right economic result. That's not the right social result. That's not the right political result. And that's the mission you are kind of empowered with. And that's the motivation. And that's how you hold on the agenda. And that's more or less the same with the taxation of multinational companies. So the feeling that you work for public good, which was the case, which keeps you abreast.
Can I just ask, in terms of being able to explain complex ideas in a succinct manner, that's obviously a skill. What about negotiation skills? Because, you had quite a few different constituencies to satisfy in these type of negotiations, whether it's at a countries or just lots of different vested interests.
No, you're right, Ali. The core of the work was, to be a carpet seller, as once the Saudis told me, they told me you could sell sand to us because you're convinced. So you need to convince people to do fundraising and also to get mandates from the G20. That's one thing. To do that, you need to explain what is broken. And when you see a minister, you cannot be technical. You cannot get into the details of Article 9 on transfer pricing. The third thing is, once you have the mandate, you need to find a path. So you need to fix objectives that you can meet. And that's where it's a bit difficult and you need a good judgment call. If you're too slow, you lose political support because you will deliver after the ministers have left the office. So you need to deliver while they are in office. Thus, a pretty crazy schedule that I fixed. You also need to be realistic in what you can achieve. But if you're too realistic, you don't change anything. So that's where you need to play with the governance, get top-down approach. When leaders of the G20 mandate you, then the delegate of a country cannot object. They have to deliver. And I very much use that. So I was the one writing the G20 communique on the tax paragraph, and I was self-mandating, if you wish, with the blessing of the G20, which helped a lot in terms of delivery. And then you need to understand that countries are sovereign. At the end of the day, they decide what they want. So I had literally as many constituencies among member countries as member countries. And then you need to add business, and then you need to add NGOs. And the beauty of the work of negotiation is to navigate that and to know when what you can propose when and how you get compromises and where there is a roadblock, how you find a way to move it from your road. So that's That's the beauty, but also the exhaustion of negotiating. I mean, after 15 years, I was literally exhausted. And I must say, I couldn't stand the delegates, who are good friends, though. But when you know that in the morning, delegate from X country will say that, and then that will trigger 10 flags up on the table, you know, that's how delegates signal that they want to speak, and that you have 3 hours, and then you will have to do a coffee break to sort it out. And that's very exciting. At some point, it's exhausting. Yeah.
I guess you get to a point where you can see the track that it's going to go on, and you can see the way that the kind of day is going to play out, essentially.
You're absolutely right. As the secretariat, you know where you're going, and in advance of the delegates, but they have to take ownership. So you have to go through the phase where, like you, they will do the brainstorming, but after you, because we were paid to do the brainstorming in advance and to have a plan to know where to land. I had an instruction to my team, which is, and I say that to my students too, never ask a question if you don't know the answer or if you don't like the answer. That's very simple. But in a negotiation, don't throw out an open question. You always want people to get where you want them to get. And if you made a mistake in your assessment, then you need to readjust because you need to cope with reality. So yeah, that's some tips on negotiation.
So, Hector, I think this guy who was an accidental tax hero at the right place, right time, wanted to improve his English. I think he's ready to go for the French presidency, don't you think?
I think so too, Pascal. I think you've got two supporters from Ali and I on the way. I'm definitely mesmerized.
We have a very good and very young president, no way.
We'll be your campaign team, okay?
Thank you.
You heard it here first, guys. Tax files exclusive.
Shall we ask you some tax questions?
Yes, feel free. I'm not the tax guy, but I'll do my best to.
Fantastic. Well, actually, you know, just picking up on this, the themes that you've been talking about. I mean, one particular constituency is big business, financial services industry, and. You know, one thing is to deal with sovereign states. Another is how do you keep these guys on board? Because dare I say that it's not always been a completely plain sailing, the relationship that you've had with big business. And, you know, I thought, you know, one just has to open and look at the press and what's being written. I mean, where is your thought process between the interests of businesses generally and where taxation needs to go to, international taxation?
That's a very good question, and you can have a contradiction between where countries want to go, where business want to go, and I think each constituency needs to be clear, and then you need to find compromise, right? You need to land in the right place. Are we in the right place? I don't know. It depends on the perspective. And so I would say, as you were referring to stuff which was written not so far in Ireland, if I get it right, with the new managing director of PwC saying, well, you know, Saint-Amand says that business has to comply, but the cost of compliance is pretty big. He's right. I mean, the cost of compliance is very big and probably too big. But the reason for that, which is not necessarily a good reason, but which was, I think, inevitable, and this hopefully can be fixed in the future, was that you have G20 leaders, President Biden, President Macron, and Chancellor Scholz and others telling you need to deliver in 1 year time. And you need to deliver with 140 countries around the table, including countries which are extremely tough in tax. I mean, India can be named there. China is no easy. Italy is no easy. And Italy was the chair of the G20. So you need to come up with extremely complex rules, with many people coming up with anti-abuse here, anti-abuse there. And it is true that the administrability of the rule was not considered as a key criteria by those who were giving us orders, right? So the secretariat of the OECD was fully aware of that. You would have only the secretariat working on that. You would have a workable solution, which would be much easier. So the engagement with business, I would say, is good when business says, if you want to do this policy, this is how you need to do it, because this is how it works. And that is tremendously helpful. Engagement with business is not good when business is hiding behind technical stuff to try to prevent you to move to the policy decision you need to implement. So I saw that when we started BEPS, with business saying, oh no, there is no base erosion and profit shifting. And they were in denial, and that's not helpful. While some business said, yes, there is BEPS, but this is how you can fix it without damaging the way we do business, right? So that's the thing. Last thing, Ali, is when I started, there was no real public consultation. You had an advisory body to the OECD with a few, it's a closed body with a few people who had privileged access to the information. When I started, I said, we need to do genuine public consultation. We will not do anything without issuing a draft, getting comments, reading all the comments, revising the draft, holding a meeting, and then moving forward. And that gave, I think, an opportunity to business to comment.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, nobody's going to doubt the fact that your OECD has been effective in rulemaking. And there is definitely a cost of compliance that's associated with it. Do you believe, where we are today, that those policy measures have been effective in achieving the aims that they set out to do?
The answer is yes. Let's take three main things. One is the end of bank secrecy. I know that's not necessarily what the audience is most interested in, but
we are interested.
Well, okay. Then on that one, the answer is yes. I mean, the goal was reached. You had last year 140 million bank accounts exchanged for a total value above $10 trillion, more than I think it's 150 billion euros of tax, which was collected. And even Gabriel Zucman, you know, the economist, the French economist from Berkeley, who didn't like automatic exchange of information, now says that it has reduced by more than a quarter the amount of offshore wealth, and that it really had an impact. Now, if you look at the cost of compliance, you could say, well, the Common Reporting Standard, which is inspired from the U.S. FATCA, it's too much, and probably it's too much. But that was the price to pay for 50 years of full opacity. Is it fair? I don't know. Will it be fixed in the future? Maybe. Now it's working. If we take BEPS, I think, did BEPS fix the issues? I mean, the BEPS measures fix the issues? In large part, yes. If you take treaty abuse, I think it clearly has receded. If you take the opaque ruling, Section 5, yes, it worked. I think we killed hybrid mismatches. At least that's what I hear from the business community. The rules were extremely complex. I mean, the hybrid rules, John Peterson, the guy who was in charge of writing, I mean, did a masterpiece of complexity. But what matters is the impact, and you actually don't have to implement. Now, the third example would be Pillar 2. Pillar 2 is very complex, it's true. I think there is a transition phase where Pillar 2 requires to build systems, requires to build systems also for information exchange between countries. The facts that we rely more heavily on accounts, I mean, on the financial accounts, means that you need the tax people to speak to the accountants, and that's pretty tedious and cumbersome. I think in a few years it will be better. Could have we done simpler? Yes. But the political circumstances were such as it didn't happen. But yes, administrability should have been more of a criterion, I think, when developing. But that's not what the leaders asked us to do in a rush.
Yeah, I mean, I, as a tax practitioner, I can definitely see that there's behavioral changes. There's no doubt about that. As to the precise effectiveness of the measures, I think perhaps it's still a bit early to tell. I would like to take the attention to a different place, which is around wealth taxation. And, you know, this can be a bit more emotive, yet I think it's the Brookings Institute called it the major issue of our age. So it clearly is important, and you know, some would say that it's ultimately a moral judgment that we're having to deal with as to how we handle wealth acquisition and preservation and allocation, because there's clearly been the inequality, wealth inequality is rising. There's absolutely no doubt across the globe. So, you know, against that background, I mean, what is your view? I mean, do you believe in progressive taxation?
I'm a French man, so I live in a tax hell. I promoted a tax hell. So, yes, the answer is you need to take 100% of the wealth of people. No, I'm kidding. couple of remarks. One, I think you're right in your presentation. The world has an issue with inequalities. Inequalities across countries have reduced because of growth, because of globalization. People forget about that. But inequalities within countries between the middle class and the top 1% or the top 0.1%, you know, the Swiss bankers talk about high net worth individuals and then ultra high net worth individuals. And there, clearly, you have a concentration of wealth, which probably, I don't have the data, but probably equals what happened at the end of the 19th century, before personal income tax would be put in place, because we went through a revolution, an economic revolution with the tech companies. And so you had something like quasi-monopolies, and they generate ultra-wealth. That's one. Two, because of globalization, we had a competition between countries to attract capital, which was mobile. And with bank secrecy, it was very easy to delocate your capital. So you have more capital owned by fewer people on the one hand, and on the other hand, you have competition. What's the outcome? The outcome is, for the past 40 years, you've had a trend towards reducing capital taxation and increasing the taxation of labor. Through VAT, through personal income tax. And because capital was so mobile, countries decided to lower capital taxation. Wealth taxes have disappeared across the world. Inheritance duties are gone or almost gone. And the taxation of capital gains is very uneven. Many countries don't tax capital gains. The taxation of dividends is very often flat and not progressive. And frankly speaking, this is wrong. I mean, the economic theory could tell you, well, you want to reduce the cost of capital to generate more growth. But then if you're consistent with that theory, you just eliminate corporate income tax and the taxation of capital. And then you end up with revolutions, which are not good for economic growth either, right? So when you go back to basics, you realize that you can do better. And that's where exchange of information comes in. Because in a world where tax administrations cooperate, you can exchange information on wealth, on capital. And that's where automatic exchange of information, which may sound technical or just fighting fraud, can help rebalance taxation towards more or better taxation of capital income.
And I take this, and this is an important conceptual and philosophical point whereby you're seeking to redress balance through interventions. And if we magnify this and take this to the level of nation states, in some quarters, OECD has been criticized as representing the rich man's club. So, you know, we have seen certainly other factions, other nations, gathering around the UN, and the UN has been very forthright in that they want to be setting the global tax agenda. And you, I know, you managed to wear so many hats that, you know, where is your thought process in that? You know, should the developing world have a greater say than they have hitherto have had?
So we're moving away from wealth taxation, because wealth taxation or better capital taxation, and just to finish on that before moving to the UN, I believe what will be done one way or another is a work on personal income tax harmful practices. That's how the work on corporate income tax started in the 90s and ended up with a minimum tax. I think on personal income tax, that's going to be the same process. It will take years, but it's needed. And by the way, you may have noticed that the G20 under the Brazilian presidency did put on the agenda wealth taxation with Gabriel Zucman as a speaker, which is quite interesting. Now, Brazil is the link with the UN, because also at this G20 meeting, the UN was invited as a full-fledged speaker like the OECD, which is quite new. And that reflects some form of fragmentation of the world and some competition between the UN and the OECD. It's been 20 years that some NGOs or some organization and countries said, well, we need to move to the UN. It is the case that the OECD delivered, and we delivered in an inclusive manner. I mean, the Global Forum has today 175 countries on an equal footing, and it's a family, and they feel comfortable there. The inclusive framework on BEPS has 140-plus countries, but it is not a family. And it's interesting. I mean, I was frustrated. I was aware of that. It's not a family because developing countries don't really feel at home there. It's the rich man's club which hosts them. It's too complicated, too fast, not reflecting their needs enough. At least that's their perception. And when you add the geopolitical fragmentation to that, I mean, China, US, and the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the North versus the South, you had this resolution by Africa, Nigeria led, to say, we need to have a UN group. And the UN group met a few days ago. We'll meet again in a few days in March and then in August to come up with a framework. Now, what do I think of that? I mean, of course, I'm OECD tainted, and the OECD is not the rich man's club that is depicted. Colombia is a member of the OECD, Costa Rica is a member of the OECD, and you have many others which are emerging economies, not to mention Mexico, for instance. But it is true that it's not fully inclusive. Now, what do you want? Do you want global rules which are endorsed by everybody, which is what the Common Reporting Standard is, which is what BEPS has become, which is what Pillar 2, which will have an impact, which is already having an impact because many countries and critical mass of countries are implementing? Or do you want an inclusive debate in a body which is fully legitimate, like the UN, but which may not deliver consensus? And if you don't deliver consensus, you deliver chaos, you deliver alternative rules. And in a fragmenting world, not to mention the upcoming US election, which is possibly scary, you may be in trouble. So I guess the challenge for the UN, and I wish them good luck, of course, is to find a way where they could complement the OECD. I'm the first one to recognize, and I was frustrated when I was with the OECD, that OECD countries were probably not generous enough with setting up the agenda in favor of developing countries. There are items, mining, taxation, withholding taxes, which are key to developing countries, simplified rules for developing countries, that the OECD should have done. I even asked the G20 to mandate the OECD to do a report on tax and development. So we know what to do, but it was not followed up. So the UN may add to this if it tries to compete or to provide alternative rules. I fear that it may contribute to more chaos, which would not be good for anyone.
Well, thank you very much, Pascal. These are really interesting points and a lot for our listeners to think about. And I know you're such a good friend of WTS Global. We were there in Singapore late last year. There is a separate webinar which you have done, so I would definitely urge listeners to listen to that as well. So thank you very much for your tax insights. I know that ECTA is getting somewhat hungry and for the roasting round. He has been prepared. Over to you, ECTA.
He's been primed and prepped. No, I mean, look, Pascal, the whole conversation that you had just mentioned is so topical, right? Because like you said, it sounds like a tax technical issue, but actually there's so much relevance around emerging economies and kind of how tax is treated on a global platform and a global stage. Before we kind of go into, you know, the rapid fire round, with globalization on the mind of, you know, a lot of these policies, like you said, CRS and Pillar 2, Do you think the tax system will ever get there? Do you think you'll get to the tax system will get to a point where it's a little bit more kind of on a global scale that people are adhering to and are happy with? I guess where the states are different places
It's done. The real pending question that you didn't ask or you haven't asked so far is Pillar One, you know, the reallocation of taxing right between countries, which is the next frontier you have two others, personal taxation, we talked about that, and carbon taxation, which is the next big thing. But I think we're there. I mean, Pillar Two, you have the critical mass of countries and it is having an impact. So the answer is yes and more to come.
Exactly that. Quite uplifting to leave our sort of tax listeners on. And there's, like you said, it's developing every day, right? So we're in the right sort of stage of things. It's just about kind of heading towards that direction.
Yeah, tax remains relevant, exciting and sexy. You know, when I started this a few years ago now, a couple of decades ago, I mean, tax was of no interest. International tax, nobody was interested. Now it's real sexy topic. So let's enjoy.
I completely concur. I mean, I go out to parties and that's what I talk about these days.
Yeah. And you have success.
And I guess looking back, Pascal, how the career has panned out, like you said, right place, right time. Is there anything that you would have changed looking back at your career? Is there anything that you think, you know?
Yes, absolutely. Oh, yeah, I would. I would have never done tax. I wanted to be an actor, but I was too shy or not too risk adverse to get there. So I would trash all that and would be an actor, movie actor. Yeah, absolutely.
So did you bring any of your innate acting skills to the world of taxation?
Yes, that was the right. That was not the right scene, but yeah, I did.
Pascal, never say never. You might be the leading role of the first sort of feature film for WTS Hansuki, a tax about the future. Never say never. Well, look, without further ado, we are going to go into what is essentially my favorite part of the conversation, the rapid fire round. Before we head in, Pascal, what have you heard about it? Are you nervous? Are you good? What are you feeling?
I'm good. I look forward to it.
Right, so without further ado, Pascal, let's kick off. Football or rugby?
Rugby, of course. I'm from the southwest of France, so it's rugby. I don't even know what football is, whether it's soccer or football. I don't care, rugby.
What is your favorite European city?
I think Paris, then Rome, and I wouldn't name the UK London because it's no longer in Europe.
Very clever. Picasso or Monet?
Picasso. Yeah, no doubt.
Your favorite film of all time?
My favorite?
Film of all time.
Favorite film? There are so many. I love Woody Allen's movies, the first ones. I mean, the 1980s movie. Oh, there are so many. I love the Philadelphia story. Okay, let's go with the Philadelphia story.
Amazing. TikTok or Instagram?
Instagram. I'm not on TikTok. I'm on Instagram. It's private and I enjoy it.
Simple or glamorous, Pascal?
Glamorous, of course. You know what? My daughter is a model agent. My son is an artist. So glamorous.
There you go. You're surrounded by it.
I am, and I enjoy it.
Pillar one or pillar two?
Well. You know, I'm compassionate with pillar one because it may never happen. But pillar two is a successful kid. So which one do you choose? I can't choose. I'm the father of both.
Corn. The jury's out on that one. AI or blockchain?
I don't understand blockchain. I have pure natural intelligence, little, so I will say AI.
Physical books or audiobooks?
Oh, physical books only. I read every night before sleeping. I read. I'm currently reading Master and Margarita from Bulgakov. I enjoy it so much. So that's my only time in the day where my brain rests by being in company of a good friend who's an author who makes you more clever and sleep better.
Ninjas or pirates?
Pirates.
I'm surprised because if I'm not mistaken, you are now Order of the Rising Sun or something. The Japanese decided to get you a big kimono or whatever.
You're right. You're right. Yeah. I am extremely proud. So, you know, I got some French medals, but when you're French and you do public service, you get them anyway. But the one which really touches me is that Japan decided to award me with the Order of the Rising Sun, a gold ray and neck ribbon, to be very precise. So no, I'm extremely proud of that.
Incredible.
Yeah, we saw that, the samurai sword and everything. It's, I'm looking forward to visiting you in Paris.
But I like Paris. I like the Caribbean too. And we did a lot of work. I mean, you know, my first peer review group meeting was in the Bahamas. That time it was Rowena Bethel, a fantastic delegate who was aware of the interest of her country on the one hand, but also she understood where the world was going, and she was trying to combine them both, and including Caribbean countries, which have always felt a bit put aside, you know, I mean, and when you're French, you have a part of responsibility of trading people, trading slaves to these islands. And then you're back to colonial behavior when you blacklist them without any explanation. That's why I brought them on an equal footing, and we tried to level the playing field. So that's why pirates, I think, need some form of respect.
And finally, Pascal, French or British cuisine?
Come on. Am I supposed to answer that question? I mean, British cuisine can be extremely good when you go to the Indian restaurant in London. Fusion food.
Authentic, so. British then, really.
French, of course.
And what's your idea of a perfect French meal then, Pascal? I need to know, what would you order or what would you make?
What I make, I mean, I love cooking, so that's what I would do. I would do, I don't know, a rice with seafood kind of a risotto on my own, which I like very much. So yeah, many other dishes which I prepare. So you're invited to share them in Biarritz with a good bottle of wine.
He's going to say, Pascal, you're going to have two very willing guests for dinner from the Tax Files next time that we're in Paris. Pascal, you survived it. Well done. You made it through the rapid fire round.
Thank you. Good.
That's all round. Was it as treacherous as you were thinking, or actually was it a complete breeze?
I survived and it was fun. So thank you very much.
Good. I'm glad. Pascal, lastly, before we bid you adieu and sort of say thank you for the time that you've shared with us, what piece of information or one quote would you like to leave with our listeners?
Things are still happening. Stay tuned and enjoy.
We like that from the Tax File. We're going to drop that, the tagline.
Exactly. Well, thank you, Pascal, again for joining us. We've had such a good time speaking to you. And hopefully for our listeners, that was an absolutely insightful discussion. Once again, listeners, thank you so much for listening to The Tax Files. It's been a pleasure having you join us. Please subscribe and get in contact if you wish to discuss any of these topics with us and our team, or if you have any questions at all. We will catch you here again at the same time next month with a most esteemed guest. To stay up to date with announcements, updates and guest reveals, please follow Hansuki on LinkedIn.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Hector, and thanks, Pascal.
Thank you.
Stay safe.
Until next time.